Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Broadway Podcast Network presents Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods, with me, Ben Rimmelauer. Today's guest, Jonathan Hadley, Rapunzel's Prince on the national tour.
Once upon a time.
Jonathan Hadley played Rapunzel's Prince in the national company of Into the Woods, directed by James Lapine, after having stood by for the role in the opening months of the tour. On Broadway and on tour, he also appeared in A Class Act, The Bodyguard, Jersey Boys, White Christmas, and Fiddler on the Roof. His many regional roles include co-starring with Leslie Uggams in Call Me Madam at the Paper Mill Playhouse, and his many television credits include co-starring with Sarah Jessica Parker on Sex and the City. Jonathan Hadley, such a pleasure to talk to you, my old friend.
Oh, Ben, this is the craziest thing. I love it. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, I mean, it seems impossible to me to think that you're someone that I know in my life in New York, and yet this original production of Into the Woods all these years ago, you were a part of that. You were Rapunzel's Prince on the national tour.
Oh, yes. And even before that, I was understudying it, and, you know, we'll get into all of that.
Okay, but, so I want to hear from the beginning.
You bringing this up, I just want to say, I had the best afternoon. It's a rainy afternoon in New York today, and I've pulled out all my memorabilia. You know, I'm from an old Southern family. Nobody throws anything away, y'all, from
Thank
North Carolina.
God. God
so
bless
you. I found reviews from the road. I found programs. I have so much crap.
Oh, I want to go through it all.
I'm glad you do. Good.
We'll have to describe it for the audio medium. But maybe we can get photos of stuff and I can put it on social media when the episode comes out.
Oh, cool.
I don't know. I don't know if everyone's like me, but I love to look at that stuff. I mean, I have here, like, I buy these like playbills on eBay, you know, just random times during the run. This one is from, let's see. I have so many of them now. This is January 89. And at that point, from the Martin Beck Theater, now the Hirschfeld. And at that point, the cast was, this is not the Flischer. I think this
89.
Is.
I think we were on the road by then.
Yeah. So this is the Broadway cast at this time was Chip Zion. Cynthia Sykes was the baker's wife. And Tom Aldridge and Bob Westenberg were still there. And Nancy Dussault, my favorite childhood television diva, who I didn't even know was a Broadway star.
I didn't either. Yeah.
Right? I mean, she was at Muriel Rush. Yeah. Barbara Brynn, Pamela Winslow was Cinderella.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then and Maren Mazie was Rapunzel.
Oh, I remember. Absolutely. We kind of joined the Into the Woods family around the same time. And I pulled one out here. We'll talk about from the Parker Playhouse, Fort Lauderdale.
Fort Lauderdale.
This is our first preview where we teched.
So oh, wow.
We get yeah. Yeah. So.
Okay. So let's start from the beginning. Before sure. Into the Woods even came into your life, were you already like a Sondheim nerd? Did you like know Sweeney Todd by heart? What was your background with the master?
I was basically weaned on Sondheim. I grew up listening to all the albums I could. Of course, we had albums. I knew Pacific Overtures backwards and forwards as a little boy in North Carolina.
As a little boy in North Carolina, who introduced you to Pacific Overtures in North Carolina as a little boy?
My parents are both educators. They're theater people, theater professors in colleges. So they had this amazing musical theater record collection, and I would just sit, you know, hands under my chin and listen to Lynn Carew and Glennis Johns. You know, I don't know what my friends were listening to. You know?
I mean, I that's Andy. Awfully intellectual, like Pacific Overtures. I mean, that's hard for me now, and I'm, you know, 47. I mean, yeah. That's quite a...
Well, that's interesting you say that. That reminded me to tell you intellectual when we got to Charlotte Ray. That's something that came
Oh, my God. Okay. So you already have this background.
Yeah.
And then what happened? Did you go to school and then move to New York, or what was
that? Yes, I went to the North Carolina School of the Arts to get rid of my accent.
Well, they did a great job, as you would expect.
I was in class with Mary Louise Parker, and Joe Mantello was two classes ahead of me. So I was in that era. Do the math, y'all. And then I moved right to New York, got my equity card doing a theater work show, a TYA show, you know, most of us do.
Yeah.
And then began this journey. So I was pretty much right out of school. I guess I was maybe 23, 24.
Wow.
And I went, you know, I hit all the open calls I could after I had my equity card. And I went to an open call for a little night music that was going to be the Kennedy Center starring Lee Renick.
Oh, wow.
And it ultimately never happened because she got ill and passed away.
Oh, God.
But Joanna Merlin was casting it.
Mm.
And I went in, of course, Henrik is my dream role. I played the cello, kind of. But I never played the role. But anyway, I went for that. But I didn't get that. And then she remembered me and called me in for Into the Woods. So I remember going to see it when it was originally on Broadway, when it first opened. And I thought, well, it's not really a part for me. I kind of fall between Rapunzel's Prince and Jack and the Beanstalk. Yeah. And that's exactly what she called me in for, was the cover for Rapunzel's Prince and Jack.
So, that was the Jeff Blumenkrantz track, yeah?
Oh, exactly, Jeff.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. So I, you know, the show had been running, and I was, you know, you helped me bring back all these memories of the last few days. Anticipating this podcast, so much of this is coming back, and one great memory was the audition, which was like being in an old movie because it was on the stage of the Martin Beck.
Oh my God.
You know, I mean, we don't do that nowadays, right?
Yeah,
I feel like that was sort of the end of that era, maybe in the late 80s. I don't know, because now they can't afford to rent the theater, have the theater for auditions. But then I guess they had the theater. So I remember walking to the theater, you know, with a big inflatable boot on it.
Yeah.
You know, that was so cool. And terrified, but excited. And then waiting in the wings. And just like All About Eve, you know, they call you out on stage. I'm on the stage of Into the Woods, you know.
God, it's like you make your debut even if you don't get the part.
Absolutely, you know. And I expect, you know, to see, you know, Betty Davis sitting out there. But no, it was Mr. Sondheim and Mr. Lapine and Gemignani and I guess the producers. I don't remember.
Yeah.
And I remember singing. Well, I don't remember what I sang, whether they gave me something to sing or I sang something. But I do remember Paul Gemignani stood up and came down to the front of the stage and said, could you sing the end of In Praise of Women from Little Night Music?
Yeah.
And as we talked about, I was such a Sondheim lord. I'm like, sure. So why didn't she wouldn't, therefore they didn't, the woman's mind. You know, I dumped it out.
Uh-huh.
They were like, great. And I was so proud of myself that I knew that, you know. And I don't remember if I read anything. I can't remember. But shortly after, I mean, I heard pretty quick, I got the job. It was amazing. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Terrifying. So, I mean, you must have just been, I mean, overjoyed, because this is pretty green in your time in New York to get this new Sondheim musical. I mean,
well, kind of. But, you know, also, I think at that age, I was like, yeah, that's how it works. I'm moving to New York and I'm getting a Sondheim show. This biz is easy, you know.
And so did how much you were cast as the cover for those roles for Jack and Rapunzel's Prince?
Right, the standby, basically.
And so, you how much rehearsal did you get before you were had to be ready to go on?
Well, here's the thing. This is another thing I pulled off my wall. I have the first day of rehearsal photograph. Has anybody shown you this?
No.
Oh, we can put this on social media. It's the whole wonderful crowd. It's dated October 31st, 1988.
Amazing.
And right down front is Martha Swope. And of course, growing up as a theater nerd, I always wanted to be in a Martha Swope.
Yeah.
And then in her, she's in the lap of Mr. Sondheim, Mr. Lapine are there. There's Charlotte and Cleo, Mary Gard Murray, Ray Gill. And there I am in the back row next to Douglas Sills. And just brings back. So, David Warren. Oh, he was our assistant director. Do you know David Warren?
Not the actor David Warren.
No, he's a great director. He's doing a lot of TV now. And he directed the first production of Harmony that I was in that was supposed to be to Broadway.
Oh, that was in San Diego, wasn't it?
No, there was one we were going. That's a whole other podcast.
Oh, God, yeah, right.
Broadway, it fell apart, and it was a disaster. Brian Darcy James and Kate Baldwin.
Right.
That was David Warren. He was James Lapine's assistant.
Oh, okay. So was how were you part of that entire rehearsal process for the road company?
Yes, they had us, which was great. They had us in at the Minskoff Studios. We rehearsed. I don't know if you were here then, but
no,
were the big studios. It was 890 downtown.
Yeah,
and the Minskoff overlooked Broadway. It's kind of where the Marriott Marquis is now.
Okay,
and those were, so we were rehearsing there, which was such a cool thing.
Yeah,
I was there for the whole experience, which was great. So we got to know all the cast, and you know, I got to know. Oh, Charlotte and Cleo. And I mean, are you interested in these?
Yes, I want to know everything about it.
You're a mess. And I love it.
Well, did you know? I mean, were you like, oh, Cleo Lane, the great Cleo Lane? Or did you have to like research her? I mean, I assume Charlotte you were more familiar with at least.
No, Cleo had already been nominated for Edwin Drood.
Oh, of course. She came to Broadway first with that.
Yeah, so I knew her there, and she had just put out a CD of Cleo Sings Sondheim.
And it, great album.
Glorious. So all the theater nerds, just the Sondheim ones, were listening to that. We had that CD. I remember all my friends would listen to it. She's just a glory. She's still around, you know. She's a voice.
I don't think people appreciate nowadays how, in that time, when someone put out a CD of Sondheim music, everyone in the world that cared about Sondheim got the CD. It wasn't like now where there's, you know, I think it's cheaper to produce recordings now, especially because you can be all digital. So there's no one can possibly keep track of all the albums that are coming out all the time. But in those days, we knew we got it right away. We memorized the album, you know, every track, every arrangement.
And she did these interesting jazz interpretation of the song. So it was a new take on all of those.
Yeah.
So it was a really exciting, intense rehearsal period. I remember Mary Gordon Murray was doing the Broadway show at night and rehearsing our show during the day. And there were quite a bit of differences. So it was a little like freaky.
Bonkers.
And, you know, yeah. And then I got to be good pals with Charlotte Ray for several reasons. Again, I think this is always coming back. She and I happened to have a friend in common. I think her nephew was married to a friend of mine from North Carolina, just randomly. But then she, since I was Jack's understudy, she and I would go off and work lines together.
Mm.
Got to be good buddies like that. We both needed as much practice in that as possible. And then I had forgotten this. This came back to me today. Sort of in the way you are with Into the Woods, at that time, I was very much into the original cast of Three Penny Opera.
Oh, sure.
And I had just discovered that album and CD.
That's B. Arthur and Lotta Lenya and Jerry Orbach. And Charlotte Ray.
And B. Arthur. Did you say B. Arthur? Yeah.
Joe Sullivan, right. Joe Sullivan Lesser. Yeah.
Yes. So I got to know Charlotte, you know, Charlotte, she talks like Mrs. Garrett, you know, that's my bad Charlotte, right? But she's just, you know, and I would say, Charlotte, you know, I finally was like, could I ask you about Three Penny Opera, and she was like, oh, you know that. And I got all kinds of stories about Bertolt Brecht and Lotta Lynn. I just ate it up.
Hmm.
So we got to be buddies during rehearsals. And oh, what made me think of it, what you said earlier, one time she said to me, you know, you're an intellectual. That's Charlotte, I think, you know. Anyway, but she was great. And her portrayal of Jack's mother, has anybody talked about that yet?
No. I saw like a tiny clip on YouTube, but that's all that I know of what she was like.
Oh my Lord, she in a good way just chewed the scenery. So that scene where she comes in the second act into the giant scene,
yeah,
where she ultimately gets killed, it's
yeah,
she started at the back of the theater, like in the parking lot, basically. And you heard this, you know, that one got louder and louder. I remember Lapine would say it's the longest entrance in history. And she would run down in the middle of the stage, and it was really funny. But it went on forever, and it got longer and longer as the
tour. Wow. Now, how present was Lapine, you know, or how strong was stage management, or was David Warren on the road with you? I mean, was there anyone keeping you crazy actors in line to not like run away with the show?
Of course, very much in the rehearsal process.
Yeah, sure.
And he would come back on the road every so often, and so would David. David would put in new people.
Mm.
I remember Lapine would come out and say, I'm coming out to take out the improvements. And he also said, and I've always remembered this, even as I'm directing a lot now, it's very hard to have talented people in the ensemble because they're very creative.
Mm.
And they keep adding, quote, improvements. So at the same time, he was complimenting us. He would say, stop doing that, you know?
Yeah.
Basically.
When you talk about differences, like, you know, that poor Mary Gordon Murray was juggling simultaneously doing the Broadway and the tour. I mean, people have talked a little bit about how the concept for the baker and the baker's wife on the road was a little bit more middle American with Ray Gill and Mary Gordon Murray, as opposed to the kind of like Upper West Side Jews that they saw like Chip and Joanna as. Were there other kind of stylistic or like tone things that were sort of pronounced differences like that?
I think though, I did hear what you talked about with Betsy Jocelyn about that. I think you hit it absolutely on the head, the difference in those, that relationship of those characters. The rest, except for... Cleo's portrayal was so different than anybody else.
Yeah.
That's which I can tell you. I have a great story I want to tell you about that. Mm. To answer that question, physically, the production was so different.
Yeah.
Broadway. And in fact, you know, I said I found these reviews.
Yeah.
I found one from the Philadelphia Gay News.
I can't believe that even existed then.
And I was like, why did I save this? It's dated February 16th, 1990.
Mm.
But I wanted to share this because I thought it was interesting. He says, the author says, the production currently on stage at the Forest Theater is a somewhat scaled down version, necessarily so, to meet the rigors of a traveling company. The sets are nowhere near as elaborate as was found in the Broadway original. In fact, they were pretty much standard road company issued. So I remember we did get critiques on the road for the set. It wasn't nearly as interesting as Broadway. But I did find out why I saved this, because then he went on to talk about the actors. And he said, Adam Gruper was the baker. Yeah. Judy McLean is the baker's wife. Patty Ben Peterson was Cinderella.
Yeah.
Tracy Katz as Little Red Riding Hood. Feistier, funnier, bitchier Red could not be imagined. And then he says, and my favorite, Jonathan Hadley as Rapunzel's prince, perfectly adorable.
There you go. The beginning of the matinee Adonis.
So I was adorable in Philadelphia in 1990.
I don't doubt it.
Physically, yeah.
Yes, yes. No, and your adorableness, which has not changed. But I was just thinking about Judy McLean having done this because... she's going out on tour as Joanne in Company. It's like
yes, I'm thrilled.
Yeah,
great. It's great. Yeah.
Judy, wonderful Judy McClain, of course, who was in Mamma Mia for years on Broadway and great Paper Mill Playhouse diva and Evita, many great shows.
We began as understudies. She was understood. She was a stepsister and understudy, the baker's wife.
Oh, she started. Well, I didn't know that.
And then we both moved into the roles. I was understudying Douglas Sills.
Yeah.
Rapunzel's Prince. And then when they left, they were kind enough to move us into the roles, which I thought, hey, that's just how it works in the biz. And I got out of Into the Woods and I realized, no, it doesn't always happen that way.
Well, and it didn't happen for your whole cast either, right? Because Cleo left and her understudy didn't take over, but Betsy came in.
That's true, right? That's true, yeah.
And same with was Adam Gruper, had he been there as a standby before?
He had not. I think he came in and good point. Yeah,
but it was kind of a long tour. I mean, it must have been quite successful that you know, you stayed on the road past people's original contracts and all that.
It definitely was, and back then, like a 2-week run was a long run.
Yeah,
like I went on to do the Jersey Boys tour, which I did for 7 years. You know, and we sat, I know, and we sat down for months at a time.
Yeah.
But back in the 80s, that just was not the case. So we were doing maybe 3 weeks in LA, I think, something like that. But, you know, mostly they were 1-weekers.
You know, people are always asking me if I'm on Ozempic. And let me tell you, I do not mind them asking me that. But I'm not on Ozempic. They especially ask me that when they see me eating desserts or all the crap I eat when I'm out. But my secret is that when I'm home, when I'm by myself, I'm eating Factor. Factor sends me restaurant quality meals that are ready to heat and eat whenever I am. No prepping, no cooking, no cleanup except for like my fork. And now you can enjoy Factor meals too. Go to factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 and use code giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off. That's code giantsinthesky50 at factormeals.com/giantsinthesky50 to get 50% off.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
I mean, it's amazing, especially thinking about the show that Into the Woods is, because you think of something like Jersey Boys or Phantom of the Opera, you know, be kind of being this institution that can just park in a city and, you know, just be there for a while. But for something that's more esoteric, intellectual, less kind of like populist, at least in its appeal, if not in its actual experience, it's impressive that Into the Woods was able to do that.
I remember in Florida, which we opened at the Parker Playhouse in Fort Lauderdale and then went to Palm Beach, people would leave at intermission. The second act would start, Once Upon a Time, and they'd be like, I already saw this.
Yeah.
Let's go. And they would leave.
Wow. They came back and then left. Yes. That's really something. Yeah. I know they talked about people leaving not realizing it, and you know that they added the beanstalk and all to be continued, but that actually did come back, which decided not.
You know, the old folks in Florida, we've seen it, let's go.
Yeah, amazing.
It was funny. One thing, if you don't mind, I wanted to jump in about the back at the rehearsal process.
Yeah,
before we even got on the road.
Yeah.
Again, getting to know Cleo, who is an extraordinary person. She's so much fun. That's another part of the conversation, but her performance was just transformative. And, you know, there are these things as you go through life, seeing art and creating art, there are things that really stick with you.
Mm-hmm.
Audra McDonald, seeing her live, or a piece of art, a physical art or something. I will never forget the one day when we put the first act together and as a cast, we were all sitting, you know, to do the whole first act. I remember I was sitting on the floor, like in the corner somewhere, and we heard Cleo Lane sing Stay With Me for the first time. And I can even get chills right now thinking about it. It was unbelievable. That voice that comes from her toes.
Yeah.
Her S's are sort of S-H, stay with me. You know, she had this. And this wonderful actress, Marguerite Lowell, was Rapunzel, and they had this great connection. And it was just moving. I've never, ever seen anything like it. It
wow.
was fantastic. And apparently there's a video of that somewhere on YouTube. Somebody bootlegged it on the tour somewhere. If you can find it, I searched it once and I couldn't find it again.
I will. I shall definitely find that. What did you guys have a like invited dress in New York before you left town that wherever people locals came and saw you?
Well, I don't remember. I don't remember if that was a thing then. I don't know. I do remember going to Fort Lauderdale and starting Tech.
Yeah.
And we did a sits probe in the lobby of the Parker Playhouse.
Mm.
And I ran into recently, I was on tour with another show and I ran into an actress, Anne Rickenbacker, who was also one of the standbys.
Mm.
And I was playing, happened to be playing the Parker Playhouse. And she said, you remember that sits probe? And over in the corner was this disheveled, almost homeless looking guy. And it was Stephen Sondheim. Sitting with like piles of paper and scribbling and listening and intense. We were like, that's Mr. Sondheim. He's here. He's over there. You know, it was so crazy.
But was there like a sort of local cult of Sondheim that greeted you when you'd go to these different cities? Did you sense that you were, you know, they anticipated in that way?
No, there was not at all. There became... Oh, and I know you talked to Tracy Katz. I didn't get to hear that.
Hasn't come out yet. Yeah, okay. I've got her in the can.
Yes, I remember there were people sometimes who would come dressed up as Little Red Riding Hood. I know she mentioned that. You know, there was that thing. But no, there was a lot of skepticism. In fact, you know, going through my little archives.
Oh, yes.
A review from the Grand Rapids Press that says songs are good, but Into the Woods not so charming. So people didn't completely love it, you know. They would say, "Oh, the singers are good, but it's overly cute in the first act and pretentiously more realistic in the second." That was Grand Rapids didn't like us.
Yeah.
So I don't think we were ever kind of greeted like a Lin-Manuel would be or something like that.
Yeah, that's so funny.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems to have grown in appreciation over the years.
For sure. Did you feel, though, like playing that second act, not necessarily that it's pretentious or moralistic, but did you feel in some of those big roadhouses that like you would lose them with the sort of all the kind of ballads and the sort of, you know, last part of the last 25 minutes of the show? Was that an issue?
Wow, that is an interesting question. Again, this is coming back. How many years ago was that? Who's down the 30-something?
35, yeah.
35. Oh, I was 5 years old then. But anyway, all that coming back, I do remember because it's so ballad heavy.
Yeah.
In the second act, we'd be like, oh, they're gone. They're gone. I do remember that now. People weren't as initiated into that kind of show, I think, at that time. I do remember the tempos were a little slower on the road. That was always a bit of a fight. Randy Booth was our conductor, and he just felt with the lyrics, Sondheim was very difficult to follow if it flew by. And the theaters on the road, you know, are huge.
Yeah.
Relatively small.
Yeah.
So you're looking at these giant, the Foxes, we're having Atlanta and St. You know, St. Louis and Detroit, giant.
Yeah.
So our show was longer and they were always fighting that a little bit.
Does the size of the theater have to do with that, with the lyrics and their tempo?
It seemed to be with the sound, the way the sound would reach the back. Mm. You know, maybe sound is different now, but that was kind of his feeling. It kind of rolled through the theater.
Yeah.
And when you're, that you have to get to this, the festival, you know, that just is going too fast.
That's interesting. But did you have body mics in that tour?
Yes. They were enormous.
Yeah.
The back in the day, they were the size of those cell phones back in the day, you know.
And what is it like to be a standby on the road? I mean, I imagine people having that, it's kind of a sweet job in the city where, you know, what is it you have to, I know it changes or it's show to show, but whether it's a 2-block radius or you just have to call, but you know, you could sort of imagine having a full life where you just sometimes go on stage and sometimes don't. But being on the road with all that entails, and then do you spend a lot of time like alone in a hotel room, or how did that work out?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a whole different ball game. I've stood by in the city and on the road. I remember we did a lot of baking in hotel rooms, me and the other standby.
How do you bake in a hotel room?
We would get little apartments, you know, and I remember baking cakes. That was something, there was nothing much else to do. You know, you had to stay at the theater until your last character makes their last entrance.
Oh, wow.
That's usually the general rule.
Yeah.
And Into the Woods, it was when they all come out again right before the end. So
we'd
leave 10 minutes before the show was over.
Yeah.
You know, for a long time, there was so much excitement that wasn't a problem. But as it got on and on, it did wear on a little bit. And I remember my first time going on, though.
Yeah.
Was in Palm Beach, and Douglas got sick, I guess, and called out. I don't remember. And I had had no rehearsal. We'd been a little bit of understudies rehearsing in the lobby, like you do.
Yeah.
They threw me on. I didn't have my own costume. Douglas is probably a good 2 or 3 inches taller than I am. He's like 6'3". So I was literally swimming in his costume. I looked like Chuck Wagner's little baby brother. So it kind of worked out. But I jumped in, you know, and it's also this thing when you're a standby in that situation, nobody in the rest of the company has ever seen you or heard you.
Yeah.
Watching. So I remember they'd never heard a note come out of my body. And as I was singing Agony, already terrified in this giant costume, I look over in the wings and there's the entire company, Cleo, Charlotte, Rachel, everybody watching to see if I was any good, you know? And it's like, thanks guys, no pressure, really. I'll never forget that. That was terrifying.
I mean, I guess you said Palm Beach was only the second stop on the tour.
Right.
But seems like, because I know they talk about understudy rehearsals being a regular part of a weekly Broadway schedule, you know, regardless of whether anyone's out that week or not, just that it keeps happening so that the people stay, you know, fresh on the different roles they're covering. But if you're doing short runs at these theaters, it seems like between teching and like... I would imagine understudy rehearsals are less regular on the road.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that especially at the beginning, because we started in October, as that picture said, we opened way before Thanksgiving, so it must have been a short process. Then tech was really short and intense. No understudy rehearsals then. I know they were going to start them soon, but I think every one of us got thrown on before rehearsal started.
Wow.
Poor girl understudying Cinderella had huge bruises on her thigh. I remember Marguerite, because she never practiced falling down the stairs. And so, now it's funny, but at the time it was intense.
Yeah.
So, but then as you go on, you do get understudy rehearsal on Thursday afternoons usually, because there's no weekday matinees on the road usually.
Okay.
You'll do a 5-show weekend.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And did you come to enjoy playing one of those parts more than the other? What were you, did you get your wish when you were, to borrow the phrase, when you were cast as Rapunzel's prince, or?
No, for me, they were equal. I could have played either. I mean, I'm much taller than the Jacks than they, so I knew they probably would cast me in that.
Right.
But you cannot go wrong singing Agony. I mean, it's just glorious. And that's a memory that came back today as I was out for coffee. I remember I did get a chance to work with Mr. Sondheim, coached us on Agony.
Mm.
And I remember him saying, as we started to sing it, he stopped and said, remember, this song is a baccarol. And I'm like, a jelly roll? What, a baccarol? No, a baccarol. And I, again, I like the audition story. I was like, oh, I know what that is. you know, in Carmen, da 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 da, that famous song, that's a barcarolle. So I knew what it was, and he said, remember that with the rhythm, agony, two. It's not just one, two, three, one, two, three. It has this barcarolle feel to it. So I said, oh, of course, yes, Mr. Sondheim. I don't know if I ever actually did it or not, but, you know, it was like, oh, I got you. Yes, sir. So I've always remembered that. Yeah, yeah. So you say, you want a cha-cha? I'll give it to you.
I guess that show probably would be, even with the toughest crowd, kind of like, you know, a showstopper.
That song. Yeah.
Yeah. And how long were you standing by before you took over?
I think Doug, let's see, people started leaving 6 months. I think Cleo and Charlotte left about 6 months in. Douglas was maybe 8 or 9. So I took over then, and I think did it for about a year.
Yeah.
After that, and then, you know, Betsy came in, and she was just, she's a mess. No, she is just fantastic. I know everybody. I adore her. You know, I was going to try to say something, but no, she's so fun. I was so thankful. She and Judy and I palled around a lot on the road. Great time.
And did Chuck stay the whole time, or did you have a different Cinderella's Prince?
He did not. He's left about the same time. And the other understudy, James Weatherstone, took over. So he and I were able to be the princes, become them at the same time.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, and we both lasted the rest of the tour. In fact, he met his current wife. She was the understudy for Little Red and Cinderella, and they're still married.
Amazing.
They went at the tour, yes.
Amazing. And okay, tell me your other Cleo Lane story.
Well, again, the stay with me was just extraordinary. She was great fun. Her real name, you know, is Clementine.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and she's quite cockney, really, when you get her away from everybody. Yeah, you know, she gets this sort of thing going, you know. And we went on a bus, you know. She stayed long enough, so there were some bus trips, which are always rough.
Wow.
And, you know, can I say this? Tell me if I can't say this. She loved penis jokes.
No, please don't.
Yeah, and but she would always get on the bus. You know, sometimes she'd sit by me, and she goes, yeah, Jonathan, you know any dick jokes? And I'd be like, Cleo, come on, no. And she'd go, all right. Guy with a big dick walks in a bar, and I'm like, no, Cleo, no, you know what I mean? and her real nickname is Clemmy. That's what family calls her.
Yeah.
Clementine. She's Cleo. But she had, and I remember you talking with Betsy some about The Last Midnight.
Yeah.
Well, there are different versions of that. And on the road, it was very different, I think, and difficult because there wasn't the elevator at the end. You know, she disappears into the ground on Broadway and the video. Well, you can't do that on the road. So it would go, and the boom, crunch, boom, exploded, and then she would just sort of stomp off stage in the smoke. And so one time, and Cleo had a hard time with that. One time I remember I ran into her in the hallway of some giant theater, and you know, they're very cavernous.
Yeah.
And I ran into her. She was in her big witch wig and the beautiful costume. She was stomping down, and I said, what's wrong? And she goes, oh, that song, Last Midnight, she said, it's like long great sex with no orgasm. No way. But I've thought about that over the years. Well, not in the orgasm sense, but in the sense of, you know, it is hard to find that giant ending to that, you know?
Yeah. And they futzed with it, too, because there's that sort of alternate ending that Donna Murphy had in the version in Central Park. And sorry, it started with Vanessa Williams. And then Donna Murphy also had that. And it's hard for me to judge if it's an improvement, because when you know the first one so well, it just sounds wrong and it throws you, you know.
Yeah,
but clearly they were trying to solve that problem, you know.
Yeah, and Cleo started it down. She'd go with that boom crunch, and she had like a 15-octave range.
Oh, yeah.
And she'd start the bottom crunch, and with this high little scream, it just still wasn't quite enough for her, you know.
Yeah.
To button that song.
Well, she understands, you know, delivering an audience the satisfaction. So,
yes.
Can't cheat that. Well, what about Charlotte? Was there any kind of like, you know, backstage hijinks, dirty jokes? What was her deal?
She was lovely and funny. I remember she took, when we played LA, she took us all to her home in Brentwood. And she was a big TV star.
At
a big deal. She was very sweet, had a lovely spread for all of us at her house. And we walked in. I remember all her furniture was covered in plastic. I'm like, Charlotte, you're a big TV. This is like an old Jewish grandma house. And she's like, I don't really want to get messed up, you know. And her Tony nominations were in the bathroom, which I thought was hysterical, you know. And she was, Christmas, we all chartered a little boat in Fort Lauderdale to go ride around and sing Christmas carols. And she kept saying, let's sing Jewish carols. And we're like, sure, there aren't any, you know. So
that's funny.
It really was funny. And her TV friends would come to see her at the show. And that was really cool backstage with the cast of Facts of Life, you know, and all that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because that run of Facts of Life must have just ended when this was blowing up.
He was still at that peak of TV stardom, so this was a great thing to get her back on stage. And then after the tour closed, you know how everybody stays close for a little while,
yeah,
lights kind of dissipate. All of us went to see her, a bunch of us did, to see her at the Classic Stage Company in Happy Days, the Beckett play.
Oh, right.
And that's where she's buried in the mound of garbage.
Yeah.
Whatever. And she was really terrific. She's just a great actress.
Yeah.
She's very funny and can do all the sitcom stuff, but she's very, very good.
Yeah.
So we stayed in touch for a while. I saw her just before she passed away. I was doing the Rothschilds at New York. And she happened to see it, and we had a nice little reunion. So that was lovely.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Now, you guys were in L.A. for quite a while with this tour, weren't you?
Over the holidays, I remember. I found that program, too, at the Music Center of L.A. I guess it was the Amundsen.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was fun. And, you know, we thought we'd all be TV stars because we were in L.A. And, of course, that didn't happen. But it was still great fun.
I remember they had the poster up in my middle school music room. That was when I first knew what Into the Woods was, because it said someone's been messing with your fairy tales and it was that great artwork.
Are you from L.A.?
I didn't know
that. Oh, I forgot that. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, from the Valley.
That was fun. It was a big hit there.
Yeah, I remember being really sad. I sort of only kind of took notice of it after it was over. And then, you know, I was in middle school, so I hadn't really started like mobilizing to like see shows that my parents didn't take me to yet. But then I managed to steal the VHS tape that had the PBS broadcast on it, and was like, and eagerly watched that and was, you know, totally obsessed. And I think that, I think that's key to why the show wound up, you know, kind of having this exponential impact, because so many people got to experience it that way.
That was actually fun for us, because some of the cast members, like Chuck Wagner, went back to tape it, so the understudies got to go on. So,
you said his understudy was James Weatherstone?
At that time, I think actually it was Douglas. Douglas Sills went on for him.
Then you got to go on for Douglas. Oh, how cool.
Yeah. And, you know, Douglas, by the way, he's such a terrific actor and so funny. And I did, you know, as I found my own reviews, I was looking at them and they were, but really everything I did, I stole from Douglas, because he's just terrific. So he was great. It was fun.
That was kind of his first gig too, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't remember what was right. Maybe Secret Garden. He went into that after that, maybe.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I know it was Scarlet Pimpernel when, you know, everybody really kind of was like obsessed with him.
Yeah, he was wonderful. And,
so
and
good.
Of course, that original cast, you talked about Ray Gill some, and he was quite wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me your feelings about Ray Gill, because he's another one that, I mean, I think I said this to Betsy, that like Lapine, Chip Zion, and everyone spoke of him Mary Gordon Murray, so reverentially and with such affection. And apparently, I think it was Ira Weitzman had told me that James had really wanted Ray as the Baker originally. And I still don't really understand why he didn't do the role. He must have been doing something else, because he had to be sold on Chip.
Yes. And that's actually how I knew him before. He was doing Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh, yeah.
He originated the role of the son, Bully.
Oh, Bully, yeah.
And a friend of mine was actually the props mistress. We were roommates. And our, you know, at the end, they feed Miss Daisy a pumpkin pie. Our refrigerator was full of pumpkin pie for a year.
Yum.
Yes. So I had met Ray that way.
Mm.
We ended up on the road together, which is great. And, you know, he used to be Kevin Kline's standby. He stood by for in Pirates of Penzance. And so Ray was this tall, gorgeous, hunky dude. And by the time he was playing Bully, he'd gotten, you know, a little dumpy, you know. He said, yeah, I couldn't handle that anymore. He said, I started eating.
So the pumpkin pie. Kind
of, yes. So he was a little bigger, a little rounder. And that was sort of that, I think, as you characterize it, I think rightly, the Midwestern sort of look.
Yeah.
You know? His baker was a little slower and a little like, oh, maybe we should go in the woods, you know, rather than the sort of neurotic New Yorker.
Yeah.
And he was a sweetheart. It was very sad when he passed away. That was rough. And of course, that was the height of the AIDS epidemic.
So yeah.
It was right in the middle of that. That was
hard. Were you still on the road when he died?
No, I think it was when we got back. But I mean, I guess I could tell the story. It was, I don't think he would mind because he was very open about it. He got not well on the road
and
got tested. For AIDS, everybody, you know, that was just a terrifying time. And he came back negative. So everything. And then when he got off the road, turns out that had been a false positive, a false negative. So he tested positive when he got off the road and sick. And he called all of us to kind of say, okay, just double check from now on, and which was very nice. He made sure that message got out to double check everything.
I guess in those days, the fear was still a little more, the science was less obvious to everybody, where now if you didn't have sex with somebody, you wouldn't necessarily be freaked out for being around somebody with AIDS. But back in those days, there still was this, you know, sense, you know, more like early COVID or something, where it was like, you know, what was your contact chain?
That's the exact perfect analogy. And, you know, the whole second act, I don't know if you've talked about this or others have, you know, it's often been allied to the AIDS epidemic, that they're running away from something. And you asked earlier, did Lapine ever come out on the road? When he did come out, he was always tinkering with the giant scene in the second act, because it's a difficult scene to stage, you know, where everybody comes in and the giant ultimately kills the, you know, Jack's wife and the steward and everything.
Yeah.
It's a difficult scene to stage. It's got everybody in it. It's all Lapine. It's not Sondheim. It's all dialogue. So he was always trying to figure how to stage it better on the road. There were no platforms on the road, so it was all flat stage.
Yeah.
Also tinkering with the dialogue, because that was the message, which he always told us is, what do you do when there is a disaster? The giants, the royal family runs away. The witch tries to fix it. The others are confused. They don't know what to do. So it was their answer of what was happening during the AIDS epidemic. Right?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I have heard that, you know, and then other people have said it could be anything. It could be nuclear proliferation. It could be climate change, you know, and obviously there's new resonances in today's world. But sure. But to be... yourself, you know, a young darling of the Philadelphia gay news.
adorable, I think. Adorable. Yes.
to be, you know, to be on this tour where literally the, you know, leading man you start with, you know, goes home sick with AIDS, you know, as you find out while you're still on the road playing those scenes, that must have been really kind of meta and intense.
Oh, yeah. And it just, you know, COVID, as you said, it's a perfect analogy. You just have to live with it and find a way to live with it. But there's always this threat.
Yeah.
And then the show, the themes of the show, it's certainly not as dark as it could get. It lightens, you know, it becomes fairy tales. But that was always there. That was there until at least I'd say this whole tour, which ended in sometime in 1990, I think.
Yeah.
1990. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Very interesting time. Yeah.
Yeah. So did you, when you got back from this experience, you know, Were you now jaded going into the rest of your career, having had this first?
You know, I went and auditioned for, I got auditions for every other Into the Woods. I never got cast in Into the Woods again.
Really? Nowhere?
Stephen Sondheim cast me, y'all, but no, nobody. So I've never done it again. I've directed it. You know, it's doing in high schools and colleges now.
Yeah.
But, and that was a good, fun to revisit it that way. But no, I never got into it. And then, you know, also, especially back then, when you went on the road, when you're gone, you were gone.
Yeah.
There was no way to contact anybody. Mm. So certainly the contacts of the people we made were terrific. But it was like disappearing for 2 years. And then I didn't realize that. You have to really start all over again, go back to the open calls and all that. I thought, well, here I am, everyone. Here are my reviews. I'm adorable. Yeah. Nobody cared. So it was a huge lesson in showbiz.
Yeah.
You know, all things, knock on wood, turned out. But it was, that was a big one. Your first one is hard. You all, I think as a young person, I see them all in these young Broadway shows and they're like, I'm set for life. Well, not quite, but you know.
What are the things that you, when you've directed Into the Woods, like what are the ways that you, what are the things you've tried to impart to the cast? I mean, I happened to talk earlier today to Burke Moses, who, was fired from the final workshop playing Rapunzel's Prince. Well, he had been, this is such a whole complicated story. He was cast as Rapunzel's Prince for Broadway. And then maybe you know this already, but then Bob Westenberg was in the Crucible at Arena Stage. So, and Burke was going to be covering that role of the Prince and the Wolf. So they said, well, you'll do this for this 2 week workshop rather than your own part. Oh. And he felt that he floundered and they were unhappy with him. And then he got the call that he was being replaced for Broadway by Chuck Wagner. And he had a contract. I mean, he was paid for the year, but what he was talking to me about was how he was fresh out of acting school at Carnegie Mellon. And he'd been trained in like a 9-month Meisner process that was useless to him in landing the sort of punchlines and, you know, getting to the end of the point in these scenes as the Prince. And you know, he felt that he didn't learn that skill for years later. And I wonder how you have guided your casts have you felt that's been a challenge for people to understand the style of these characters in the fairy tale world?
You find that in general. I also just happened to direct Something Rotten, a really talented bunch of college students. They were great. But they don't have this waka waka sort of sense of humor.
That vaudeville was the word.
Yeah, a Carol Burnett sort of, you know, Mel Brooks. Not that Into the Woods is that, but it certainly has it in there. It certainly can help.
Yeah.
So I found that some of that is just basic understanding of the jokes and saying, let's make this funny. It's okay to be funny.
Yeah.
Find the humor in all of this. It can be, people can try to get really heavy about it. And people get so concerned about the singing of it, you know, belting things like the justifies the beans. That's like, people freak out about that.
Yeah.
Let's get to that in a minute. You know, what is the moment and what are you singing about? And, but I also, as we just talked about, where the show came out of that era of the 80s, I try to talk about that as well. And liken it to something in today's, you know, it's also, we just, but yeah, it's interesting that you bring that up.
Yeah, that's, and then, you know, some of the old timers, when they talked about did you see the revival last year?
Oh no, I did. I missed it. I saw the second revival, right? The 2000 and whatever that was.
Yeah, there was 2002, and then there was the off-Broadway one that was like really cool. And then Fiasco Theater, and there was one in the park, and then there was this City Center one, and then they went on.
I was on the road with something. I was on the road with a play, and I missed it. But Brian Darcy's a good run. All that I should have seen.
I mean, it was great to see, and I got to see it a lot of times actually. So I got to see all these wonderful actors that, you know, because it was still such a simple encore staging, they were really able to just keep rotating the cast to keep it running.
Yeah.
But some of the complaints from some of the old timers, like Joy Franz, was talking about.
Joy, we got to work together. She came in as the road too.
Yeah. She was very mad because her credits were not correct for that on IMDb. But she was saying that, you know, some of the actors were kind of dressing up the line to like add comedy, you know, instead of just kind of playing what's there. And it seems like maybe people tend to go one way or the other in the wrong direction, either, you know, not honoring the sort of vaudevillian elements that help tell the story, or kind of gilding the lily with kind of like business that is not the point.
Yeah, I mean, even the simple lyric, you know, oh, you know, when you know she would go with you if there only were doors. That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you don't have to do too much to that. You got to do a little something, but not, yeah, you know, too big. But there's plenty in there. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Oh, that's joy with
simple. If there only were doors, it's a really good example, because that can be so funny. And yet sometimes the lyric can slip by unnoticed. And like, what do you think it is about, like kind of like landing that point so that the audience gets that, you know, irony or whatever it is that's so funny there?
Yeah, or the reality of looking up in the tower and there are no doors. How am I going to get there? And how is she going to... Oh, you know she would go with you. There only were doors. Help, you know. I mean, that kind of thing. It's just, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
You mentioned the tasks unachievable, and then you get into all of that. But yeah, to me, it's the reality of that moment. You know, just don't let it go. Just see it. And again, I stole that from Douglas Sills. Thank you, Douglas Sills.
And do you, you know, some of the actors have talked about when they did long runs in this show, like, you know, getting into a rut where they found something that landed and that they loved and then cherished and then got static, or, you know, and then it didn't, it stopped getting the laugh, and then they wanted the laugh back, and the harder they worked, the worse it was. Was being on the road, did that help with that? Because things are mixed up automatically, whether you like it or not. So you're constantly kind of in a fresh space, literally. I mean,
100%. Audiences change, theaters change. Again, I mean, doing Jersey Boys for that long, a period in 7 years, as soon as the show starts to get a little tired or you get tired, you're in a whole new town. You're in a whole new dressing room. You have a whole new crew. Everything is new. And the jokes, you know, you have things that do, you know, work, but also some crowds get some things and some crowds don't.
Yeah.
Regionally, it's also very different. Some parts of the country are laughers and some are not. And it's absolutely true. I remember we played at Judy McLean's hometown in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And they all just sat there very stone faced. And that, she's like, yep, those are my people. they're just not big laughers, you know? And you learn that as you go, and it changes your performance. And to me, that keeps it, it keeps it fresh.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you're a fresh take. I love hearing your stuff.
For an hour. I can't believe, wow, there's so much.
Flies by. I mean, any more memorabilia you want to share with me?
I have the programs, and those were the reviews I found. Oh, I found our, you know, the insert that has everybody's pictures. We all had big 80s hair.
Oh, I love it.
But my hair is enormous.
Oh, please send me that.
Look at us all. I look like I'm 11 years old, but anyway, it was great.
Yeah. Oh, gorgeous.
Mother,
I love
taught me to save these things. So now they're
Do you have any merch? Were there like hoodies or anything?
Oh, I have a show jacket.
Oh, I want to see it.
Oh, I still have it. I chucked it away somewhere.
Get
but
a picture and send it to me.
Yeah, you know, they used to encourage us to wear those around town.
Oh yeah, free advertising.
Free advertising, and they were these leather sleeves, you know, I said our Prince on it, and people would go, hey, you with Prince's band? Rapunzel into the book. Anyway, you know, literally people would stop me.
Amazing. Oh, that's great.
You brought back such wonderful memories. This is great.
Oh, thank you for sharing them, Jonathan. It's so good to talk to you, as always.
Absolutely.
Well, I'll let you know when this is up. I know everyone's going to enjoy it as much as I have.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you for listening to Giants in the Sky, How Sondheim and Lapine Went into the Woods on the Broadway Podcast Network. Look out for episode 41 with Jackie Dankworth, Cinderella in the original London cast, and Cleo Lane's daughter.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.